Welcome to Cyber Therapy. I am Ashley, your host, and next to me is my co-host, Tyler Shields. Want to say hi?
Hey, how you doing, Ashley? Good to see you again. It's been 2 weeks since we've done the last episode. A lot changes in 2 weeks. How has your last couple of weeks been?
You weren't even on
2 weeks ago, were you?
Correct. It's been about a month since I was last on. Before I get dive into that, for anybody who's new here, glad that you're here. I'd love for you to subscribe, hit that notification button, make sure you got that bell so that you know when the next episode comes. But this is a show where we talk about the human side of cybersecurity. So we get to talk to a lot of different people who are either in the trenches of security or security leaders as well. So I'm excited for the guest that we have today. So what have I been doing for the last month? Well, recovering from Hacker Summer Camp was one. Two, went to a friend's wedding, did some travel, and actually about to travel again after this episode because we got our marketing on site. So I'm super excited.
Did you have a good time at Hacker Summer Camp? It was your first one, correct?
Yes. B-Sides was awesome. And I really loved the vibe of B-Sides. I'm not gonna lie, I was a little bit intimidated by how many people were there, but it was great. Great experience. And then we did our thing at Black Hat because we were sponsoring there. I think next year I want to be able to make sure I can go to DEF CON as well, just to get that whole experience. But I couldn't this year because I had my friend's wedding to go to. So,
gotcha.
Yes, you know, those once in a lifetime kind of experiences.
Yeah, friends are important.
Mm-hmm. Bam. How about you? How have you been for the last month? The last episode was with Carter, right? Our host from 100x Engineering.
Yeah, for those of you that did see that, I played chess against Carter, and we had just kind of a one-on-one, a little tete-a-tete conversation. Got to know each other a little bit, and hopefully others found it interesting. And I kicked Carter's tail in chess, and he decided he was going to try to challenge me afterward again. And I'm kicking his tail a second time in turn-based chess online. So if anybody would like to have a shot at me in chess, I'm not very good, I promise you, but good enough to kick Carter's tail. Feel free to look me up on chess.com and we'll get a game going.
Do it. I will personally give a gift card to anybody who is able to beat Tyler Shields.
There's a lot of people out there that'll beat me in chess. My rating is really not that good, but good enough to crush,
people who listen to Cyber Therapy. Carter. Okay. All right. Before we bring on our guest, I wanted to ask you a question because I think it'll tie into today's theme. And was wondering what your thoughts are behind building a team. Typically, when you are building out a team, what are you looking for? Are there certain like hallmarks, personality traits, stuff like that, that you're looking for when you're building out a team?
It's a super good question. And there's no easy answer to this. I've hired in the dozens of people now across my career for different roles, different positions, different companies. And for me, it's largely dependent on the stage of the company and the type of the person I'm looking for. And what I mean by that, like, I think it's a given to have a certain level of capability, like tactical capability that you have to have, or I'm not going to hire you, period, full stop. But then beyond that, it's the intangibles that I look for. And so I tend to be staffing smaller startups in the, let's call it 0 to 20 person marketing team size, right? And even 0 to 20 changes pretty drastically. Mm-hmm. When you're in the 0 to 5 range, what you're looking for is very hands-on, very tactical doers who are biased heavily towards completion of output. And that the bigger the team gets, the more managerial the person gets, the more leadership qualities you have to look for. And so I think a lot of it has to do with where you are in the stages of what you're looking for, at least when I'm hiring.
What are some of those intangibles that you look for?
Communication, drive, grit. I can't really describe it. You know, you've hired enough for it. You know it when you see it. You know where your misses have been over the course of your career, and you don't duplicate those, right? It's hard to describe how you interview for grit or how you interview for drive, right? And someone who's driven and competitive enough to win at all costs, right? And make sure we do what needs to be done to win as a small business. I can't really give you any exact questions I ask. You just kind of know it when you see it. You know when that person has it.
Okay, note to self, do some reading on other books also.
Yeah, don't go by what I say. That's for sure.
All right. Well, thank you for that. I think with that, let's go ahead and bring on our guest because she's got a lot of experience working with a lot of different teams. And I think she's got some stuff to share. Welcome, Kirsty Payne.
Hey. Hi. Yay. Welcome.
Hi, Ashley. Hi, Tyler. Thanks for having me here. It's great to be here.
Yes. And where are you checking in from today?
Today I'm in Geneva in Central Europe. Yeah.
So. And remind me why you're in Geneva.
I'm working from here. I've moved here recently. So it's very new for me, actually. Only been here just a few days. So yeah, it's very nice to be here. Still getting used to and all the cultural norms.
And recently what?
We've got some other news, right?
Yeah.
Oh, is this all about me?
This whole show is about you.
Sorry, yeah, I hadn't realized. I should be like elongated on a couch rather than kind of on an office chair. I had not appreciated. Yeah, so I recently got married, moved to Geneva with my cats. Yeah, I didn't there marry my is. Cats just in case people say I'm a crazy cat lady. So yeah, no, really good, really exciting time. Yeah.
Congratulations, Kirsty. Fantastic news. So great to hear. And I'm glad you didn't marry cats. That would have been really awkward and weird.
That would have been unique.
Yeah, one person's unique, another person's awkward and weird.
I mean. I'm not sure. I'm a pretty crazy cat lady, but even I'm like, yeah, that's odd.
This is true. Do you mind if I share a picture of your cat?
And you would like to go for it. Behind this picture? One of my favorite photos I think I've ever had of my cat. This is on the flight. As you can see, he's having a great resignation or reevaluation from his current status of not wanting to be on this flight or under the seat in front of us. But we did bring him out and sit him next to us for most of the flight. So he looks a bit grumpy, but he always looks like that. I think he actually enjoyed himself quite a lot. So
there you go.
Yeah. I love that. Man, I am really, really proud that your cat stayed with you, because I'm pretty sure if I took my black cat or my gray cat onto the flights, they'd be one of those, like, I think I just saw actually on the news or on Twitter that one of the cats got like loose in one of the flights and was like hanging out with people in first class. Like, it would be impossible to get them back. So.
If there was a film called Cats on a Plane and it had Samuel L. Jackson in it, I would watch it, right? Like all these cats running up and down the aisle. I'd be so there. But no, I mean, ours were really good. We just got stopped a lot in the airport and people asking us, like, are they show cats? And we're like, no, they're just coming.
Well, Kirsty, do you walk your cats on a leash?
I do. This is really deviating from my crazy cat lady. I'm not a crazy cat lady, but they love it, actually. They walk faster than I do. So we had to get extensive leash because they just ran ahead. Yeah, they love it.
I'm outnumbered by people that walk their cats. Like, if you grabbed any three random people off the street, I promise you two out of three would not have walked cats on a leash. But yet on this show, that's what we've got. We've got two out of three that walk their cat on a leash. And I'm not the one. I'll tell you right now, I am not the one.
I've trained one of my cats to go with me outside. My other one is just still too skittish. He prefers to like hide underneath the table like this and just prefers to not go outside. But my gray cat, he likes to go outside. He likes the outside air.
You guys need to upgrade.
He still falls over with his.
You need to upgrade to dogs. You need to upgrade to dogs.
Yes, upgrade, you are a dog lover.
Downgrade.
I don't know if it's an upgrade though. That's a lot more work.
Well, my one dog looks like a cat. Show a Which picture one? Of Bogey.
This one?
Yeah, he's almost.
I'm pretty
cat
sure this
sized.
Is not a.
He's very this cat-like.
Is he?
He's very tiny, very cat-like.
I mean, this is more cat-like because you know he's obstructing your ability to work.
Yes,
and that's what cats like to do. Like
yes,
this one.
That would be like that one. We have all sorts of animals on today's show. I do have a second animal too. For those that don't know, I have Bogey, who has a TikTok channel called Bogey the Ween, because he's a wiener dog. So Bogey the Ween on TikTok. You can go see his TikTok channel. And then I have a fat golden retriever named Rosie, who doesn't have
a picture of.
I don't have a picture. Well, we tried to get a picture of Rosie in time for the show, but we always prep for the show like 5 minutes before, where we're just doing our banter, and then all these great topics come up, and we never have the photos at hand, so we always end up missing them. But I do have the two dogs, because I'm not I am not a cat person. I'm not a cat. And that
Are
was
you sure
not.
About that?
I know we're on the cyber therapy couch right now, but that was not a Freudian slip. I promise you.
Okay.
But the fact you just said it was not makes me think more that it was actually.
All right, let's phone in this aminal topic here and get onto something meaty.
Sure. Okay. So, Kirsty, would love to kind of just dive into a little bit of your background, because I think it's really, really interesting and really unique, because one, I've never talked to a mathematician before, and two, a mathematician who's worked for basically the part of what the UK's equivalent of the NSA is. So would you mind just kind of talking through a little bit about how you went from mathematician to now strategic advisor of technology and, I'm going to butcher it, technology
innovation.
And technology innovation. Thank you. That's fun.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah, totally. I mean, so I think it's kind of good to highlight the different paths that people can take into cybersecurity, because sometimes there's a concept, if you don't get people aged sort of 10 years old straight into computer science and coding, then they've missed their chance. And I should say that I, yeah, studied mathematics at university, did a few modules in cryptography and quite a lot of pure mathematics, which lends itself very well to a job as a mathematician. So I worked for the UK NCSC, which is a part of GCHQ, as you note, which is the NSA equivalent in the UK. And there, you know, it's a really interesting job. I love that job, to be a mathematician there. It's very cool, very prestigious. There's a lot of history that goes with it, of course. And a lot of kind of security, making things more secure, understanding different attacks, understanding ecosystems. And there's a joke that mathematicians are just people who don't know how to give up on a puzzle or a problem. So you just keep going. Basically, when stuff is really hard, you just keep going. You try different approaches. You throw everything you have at it. You ask everyone you know. You know, it's a very collaborative process as well, and very different to what a lot of people imagine mathematicians do, right? They're just sort of sat on their own and with a chalkboard. It's almost never like that, I should say. It's very collaborative. And yeah, it was a fantastic role. So I worked a lot in data, big data, but also security, internet technologies mostly, and IoT. So securing the IoT, if anyone wants to reach out after this about that, I could talk about that for ages. I love that challenge, love that problem. And then from there, I moved into kind of more security and technology. So less away from sort of the mathematics and data science side and more into big systems and technological problems. And so then I joined Splunk as a strategic advisor in technology and innovation. And I have a security specialism from all that time at the NCSC, which for those who maybe don't know, the NCSC is the UK kind of national technical authority. And so their mission is to make the UK the safest place to live and work online, which is quite a succinct way of saying the massive remit they have, right? That covers like citizens, businesses, governments, everything. So it's a really fun role.
Wow. I am just in so much awe. curious. This is just something that's popped in my head. Why math?
Oh, why not math?
Because I mean, I enjoy math, but I
Ashley, why cats? Why
cats? So I think people have a conception of what mathematics is, right? Like at a young age, yeah, maybe people get really turned off from it because they don't know their times tables, or they hate just doing repetitive sums. And I also hate doing repetitive sums, right? That's not, to me, what mathematics is. People describe it as the purest science, but actually it's quite artistic sometimes, in the way you have a toolkit, a range of brushes that you choose to paint your canvas with. And, you know, you have this kind of toolkit of theorems and lemmas that you can apply to the problems that you're seeing. So, I mean, for me, I loved it. I don't know, maybe that's weird, but honestly, I thought it was like the coolest subject. And
I don't think I've ever heard mathematics, hardcore mathematics, like you're talking about, described in artistic terms before. That's a very unique view on mathematics, because typically people, at least I do, I don't know if generalized people do, but people equate mathematics with logic and function and binary answers and no shades of gray. Would you say, at the level of mathematics that you got to working for the organizations that you worked for, does it change at some point to become more artistic and more creative for you as a practitioner?
I think it definitely does. So you're kind of, in some cases, you're designing your own kind of cryptography schemes. It's never been done before. You're sort of playing around with all these different tools. And yeah, it's quite creative. But even at university level, or even at GCSE, you know, kind of 16-year-olds, yes, there's a right answer, but there's quite a few different ways to get to that same correct answer, right? So some people visualize the problem. Some people will use concrete numbers and test things out. Some people will draw shapes. And it's that kind of route to getting to the answer that's really interesting, because no two will approach a problem the same way. that's what really inspires me, I think.
Yeah, that's a super interesting background. I don't think, like I said, I don't think I've ever heard of it kind of spoken that way, but certainly when you describe it, I think, you know, a lot of people in the computer science realm too, when they get into the higher levels of it, and even like higher levels of development and pure coding, you start to become real creative in your algorithmic design and the way you approach, just the structural nature of what you're building. And so I guess it can be applied in a creative manner.
Oh yeah, well, I always say this because it's a programming language. And so languages are traditionally humanities, right? They're traditionally arts. And it's called a language for a reason. And that's because it allows you to create a story or create a code base, however you want. And there are several ways, as we know, to code the same thing. Some are cleaner than others, but everyone can use that language to create their own story. I think that's maybe if we spoke about it more in those kind of terms, it might inspire a few more people to learn a language. And instead of it being French or Spanish, they learn coding.
Yeah.
That's super cool. I love that picture that you are painting of just a different way to look at how to make your way into basically tech, right? So I wanted to go back to something that you said, where you said mathematics is, you know, there's a lot of collaboration that goes on. And I think from your experience, you've worked on a lot of transformation journeys. And I think we all know that transformation journeys require a lot of collaboration as well. In addition to the technology and, you know, the processes and getting everything in place. If you had to, I guess, break down the amount of time you spend on the people problem, the business problem, technology problem for a transformation journey, how would you split that up? And what would be the most complex or complicated part of that?
It's a really good question, because I was talking about this with a colleague actually just a couple of weeks ago. And the thing that probably surprises people most about a job in technology is that I spend maybe 5% of my time talking about technology. And people expect that to be, you know, 95% of my time. Really, that is sometimes only 5% of the discussion. And the rest of it is about the people and galvanizing the change and bringing the processes along with it. And actually, the technology is almost sort of a done deal. You know, people want to move to cloud, right? They know that's a good thing. They've heard about that. But then how, right? The process, the people, how do we get the organization in such a place we can do that? How do we bring these teams along with us? How do we explain to people who are very resistant to this change? How do we explain to non-technical folks what the change is? You know, all of these different questions. So I suppose your second part of your question, what's the most complex thing? It's easily for me the people. And it's also maybe the thing in cybersecurity that we don't upskill people up on specifically. Like, we do train people to code, we do train people in the latest techniques and defense mechanisms and things, but we don't teach them necessarily explicitly how to deal with people. And that's really a blocker in many projects I see.
So if you're going through a digital transformation project with a company, do you have any tips and tricks in the bag that you would like, hey, here's the 1, 2, 3 things that from the people perspective that works most effectively to get them on board, get them behind the mission, or to support the mission, or to get them culturally interested in kind of the transformation that you're bringing to the table?
Yeah, it's really hard, because there is no one size fits all. It's quite a lot of understanding individuals, understanding their drivers. And in fact, we've talked about this today, that understanding what really gives people engagement with a project or a company can really help you address your message in that right way. So there's a lot about communication and making sure that you are speaking to what people hear, right? Like, if you're pitching to the army about a transformation project, infamously one of my colleagues doing this, and they pulled up the slides and said, but there's no mention of tanks on here. And frankly, you're talking to like army generals, they think in tanks. So describe this cost in terms of tanks, or describe, you know, what it will allow them to do on the battlefield, because that's what they care about more. But it's true, you know, speaking the language that people hear, that's a really important thing, and working out what motivates them. Another example is a children's charity, for example, where the kind of employee engagement was consistently low. And that's because, the company spent a lot on well-being projects and things like that, and it remained low. And it's because for that children's charity, what motivated their staff wasn't how much, you know, money they got for their well-being and things they could get. It was seeing the charity's money being spent effectively. And once they addressed that driver, you saw the index of engagement go up. And so there's just understanding what really motivates people and speaks to them. That's a huge part of it.
Yeah. And so when you connect that digital transformation kind of drivers or impact to get to get the transformation moving in a human cultural standpoint, it's almost the same drivers that are done when we start to talk about building a cybersecurity program or building, you know, any kind of security effort inside of an enterprise organization. It's a massive transformational project to get people culturally aligned. And it's probably similar showstoppers there, as well as potentially in business leadership and leading a business to success. It's all about connecting incentives, getting people aligned and going in the correct direction culturally to have the impact on the end outcome that you want.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. And it segues really well into, you know, if you have business drivers that are underpinning your technical change, that's the language you need to be speaking to your budget holders to get that funding, to explain to people what's going on. And it's something I commonly see with kind of security teams and managers in particular, that they, you know the technology very well. They're very well respected by their teams and their peers, but their ability to communicate with the business and explain the state they're in, or, you know, ask for more funding in a convincing way, even though they clearly need it, or, you know, it's really interesting to see how they struggle. So there's kind of a few tips that people can employ when they're doing this. If you are a security manager and you don't really know how to talk, or maybe you're a senior analyst and you're not able to kind of share your state, the first thing is just to define and compare where you are, and check with your peers, discuss with other people where they are, and be honest. You know, have a small network, and it's people again, right? Have a small network of people you really trust that you can ask, you know, here's what I'm working with day to day. How does that compare with you? And get that benchmark, and then identify what would be better or perhaps good enough. And this, again, is a human thing. We're not used to saying it's good enough. We prefer to say it's perfect. And of course, we'll keep going to it's perfect. But saying up front what's good enough and what that gets you, you know, articulating that, okay, that is what good enough gets you. Perfect would get you this. And here's the different costs and, you know, the different time and resource it would take. And then kind of look for that recognition of what you've achieved, because that's very motivating in itself, and it creates this sort of mini cycle going around.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Wanted to look at the flip side of this and ask you, because that those are good tips to help put relationships on the good path. I want to kind of dig into, what's the most challenging relationship that you've had to work with on a journey? And then we'll go from there.
Do you know, this does sound like an interview question. It's kind of, tell me a time when you've resolved a conflict. And I'm like, yeah, quite often. I suppose, yeah, it's when personality comes into, I mean, a lot of the time it's people are stressed, or they, you know, find a certain move or a relationship challenging. And it's never what's in front of them, right? It's not probably the move to cloud. It's probably something underpinning that, right? Perhaps they're worried about their security. Perhaps they really resent the person who's leading that project, but it's actually got nothing to do with the project itself. And this is why I say people is the biggest part of the difficulty. So I suppose the first thing is to baseline and understand, try to really understand what's going on. And a mentor once told me this phrase, be curious, not furious. Someone's really frustrating you and it's really annoying and you just don't know why they're blocking things and being very challenging. Don't get mad, just get really interested in why that is. And that will almost always lead you to the answer of the resolution, right? Like if they don't rate the person leading the project, set up a conversation, get it all out, or, you know, kind of use your allies and partners that you have in the space to help you recognize what you have, what you don't have, where you could use support. You know, all of these are very hard things to admit if you have a vulnerability. And I'm not talking a technical vulnerability, I'm talking about people, you know, imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, if you get people to a psychological safety where they can say, I'm struggling with this, because that is the best way to overcome those challenges for sure. It's very difficult, but it's really worth it when you get that.
It truly is cyber therapy, isn't it, Ashley?
Yes. I feel like when you're in a transformation journey, you have, in order to successfully push things along, you have to give room for those vulnerable conversations. Because one of the things that you were saying earlier about like rolling it out and making sure people are pulling everybody along, how do you account, like, the timing for it, right? Because like with every project, you usually have a timeline of when you want to accomplish stuff, and people don't always move on the timeline, right? So how do you, or do you move forward with 80%? Like, as long as you've got the majority of the group moving in a direction, then you kind of are okay with it, I guess. But my question is, let me clarify my question. When people don't move on the timeline that you want them to move on, but you still have your goals that you have to hit for your journey, right? Your particular project. How do you handle that?
That's a really good question as well. And actually, it's funny because timelines can be very cultural. So, you know, we see time as a line, right? Like very linear, has to be done. We have to meet these certain things. There are some people who will end a meeting exactly on time, no matter what is being said, no matter how interesting, no matter how. And there are some cultures where the meeting finishes once everything interesting has been said. And it doesn't actually matter what time that is. It's just when you're done. And I should be on commission for this book, but I'm not. I just really enjoy it. It's called the Culture Map. And I'd really encourage anyone who's thinking about the way teams kind of work together or different groups of people can work together. It's such an interesting read. And it's from a woman who worked professionally with cross-cultural teams in building good collaboration where, yeah, exactly these frustrations. People weren't moving on the same timeline, or they were, you know, asking for too much detail, and you know, the clash of cultures was really interesting. It's only one example of why people might not move on your timeline. I think, you know, as leaders, you have to look at your overall strategy and see what's really helping and hindering you. And if you have a goal in mind, how realistic is that goal to start with? Do you add the flex time? Yeah, thank you for bringing this up exactly. Do you have the flex time built in? Because that's part of your project, right? And like, if you're going to wallpaper a room, it's a very good example, you buy 10% more wallpaper than you need because there will be wastage, right? You cut it, you make a mistake. Da-da. It's the same kind of thing with a transformation project, right? Like, expect there to be obstacles, plan for those. That includes people, that includes tech, that includes process. Look at it holistically and just account for that flexibility.
So this is deviating from my notes, but... What keeps you coming back to working on transformation journeys? Because I would imagine like doing it for one company is pretty like resource intensive, right? For yourself to invest in it. But clearly you like to do it and you continue to engage in transformation journeys. So what about a transformation journey really gets you like fired up and excited?
Oh, this is, again, it's like, it feels very cheesy. It feels like a sort of, you know, job interview. But I, you know, everyone says they're passionate about things. And I don't know, I think for me, I really enjoy seeing like tough problems, like difficult, you know, I said earlier, a mathematician is someone who doesn't know when to give up on a problem. Like there's nothing more complex than really transforming processes or, you know, SOCs or anything really with an organization. But it's honestly the joy that I get from seeing the before and after state. And when it does get really difficult and messy, you know, that's when you really need a good partner. You can't just have like a vendor or someone trying to sell you something. You really do need a longer term partnership. And, you know, I think that working for Splunk, especially moving in that direction with our customers, because it really unlocks a lot of potential for them. And people say security is a collaborative, you know, it's a team effort. It's not just one person or one team or one company responsible for security. And it's kind of that mission, I think, that's really enjoyable for me, is that to improve security with organizations, to unlock the potential they have of their people and of their processes and everything. That really, I really enjoy that. So that's why I keep coming back. But maybe I'm a sucker for punishment. I don't know.
What's the longest transformation project you've ever been involved with? How many months, years, decades did it take? Or are you in the middle of one that's the longest one you've ever done?
Yeah. How long is a piece of string? Are people ever done? I suppose is my response to that. I think, you know, as soon as you think you're done, you're kind of, yeah, you've maybe given up. So it's just carrying on, keep on.
Sounds like a very mathematician's answer.
It does, doesn't it? I know. At least I didn't say the limit tends to. That would have been terrible.
Yes, exactly. That would have been a horrible pun. We would not have accepted that because we don't do cheesy puns here. So.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Not at all. I have a question to dig a little bit more into what you were just saying. When you say a partner, because I've heard this phrase a lot, I think it's been used a lot to, as like a, how to cast a brand, right? To part, we are a partner with you in your, whatever you're working on. What does that actually mean? Because I think every company has a different perspective of what it means to actually partner. But for the people in the trenches and like from your experience, like on the vendor side as well, like what truly constitutes as being a partner to your customer or your vendor or whatever?
Yeah, that's a it's such good questions today, team. I think it's, again, like company specific, right? Like a partner for one is not a partner for every. It really depends on what they need. So like in a, this is cyber therapy, right? If it was like relationship therapy, you know, you have two parties that need things, different things from each other, and you understand that symbiosis, and you give and sometimes don't expect to receive anything. You have a sort of shared understanding. There's really good open collaborative channels. And for me, that's, you know, trust is built in drops, but lost in buckets. And it's actually where you have this consistent drip, drip, drip of building that relationship. And you're not there just because it's like a renewal time, or it's, you're there because you care about their success and you're building that with them. And important to say building it with them, not turning up with a pre-made thing. Look how great we are. It's really, for me, when you have hand-in-glove collaboration like that, and I've experienced it in, you know, all the organizations I've worked in, yeah. But you know what that feels like? I can't, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm quite a feeler, and you can't really just make a list of, okay, it's when you have a Slack channel and it's when you have this. It's, no, it's more when you can pick up the phone, or if that's what people want to do, you just feel like you have that open door. And you really, you know, you're their sounding board, they're your sounding board. That's a real partnership for me.
Yeah, digital transformation sounds a heck of a lot like building security into an application, building security into a culture, building security into a program. I mean, I just keep going back to those analogies because you hear almost identical talk tracks when people are saying, you know, we're building up insert security program here. We're building up an application security program, and we want to make sure that all the applications we build are, you know, as with lowest number of vulnerabilities as possible. Well, that's the outcome. The cultural transformation that has to occur to achieve that outcome is exactly what you're identifying. And I love that quote of drips and buckets. That is just such a fantastic, because as a security leader, if I go build an application security program, or I'm attempting to, I have to, you know, create a situation where it's like, hey, trust me, here's one vulnerability, or here's one way of fixing the problem, or here's one way of moving forward step by step. And if I blow that up even once, I set myself back. All those drips get dumped completely out of the bucket, and I have to start building that trust again. So I think the digital transformation storyline, you know, I was trying to figure out when we were first interviewing, I'm like, I love digital transformation. This makes a whole lot of sense for cyber therapy, but it didn't really dawn on me and click in my head about how directly applicable the learnings that you've done can be directly applied to building cybersecurity related situations.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, that kind of culture, I think, you know, when you're building security applications, I think we saw it maybe, I don't know how long ago, but a few years ago, where it's very sort of checklist for security. Like, yes, we have, and it's classic, yes, we have used AES-256. We are secure. Very tick list, right? Criteria based, rather than more principles, more holistic, more, you know, developers co-develop, right? They do peer review. Now that's just a process, but actually it leads to better security, fewer vulnerabilities, to have this peer programming. And it's not, that's not a kind of tick list. Yes, we do that because we've done it once. It's more embedded in the culture. And so I think security is evolving a bit more to realize the whole industry, just that it's not a tick list. You can't say, yes, we have logs, therefore we're good. It's more about that culture, like who shares that data, who feels empowered to act on that data, all those kind of questions around it.
Yeah, on the one of the things that I've also noticed about security culture is that there seems to be a shift from relying on like a single point of failure, like a really smart person to figure out a problem, or a really smart person who like just knows the ins and outs and everything, but like de-risking that and having more collaboration. So, but you know, not every company is quite there. So from moving from a checklist oriented or like a zeroing type of company to more collaborative, de-risk culture, so there's not more knowledge sharing. Do you have any thoughts on how, like, what are like the things that can get snowballed into the culture more collaborative.
So I think I've heard it called kind of hero culture, or, you know, those wizards, which is hilarious because I used to get called a witch, which just doesn't have the same impact.
No.
I was like, oh, I do know what you're trying to say, but it's kind of hurtful. So I think one thing we could do to remove hero culture would be to call it like witch culture, and no one would want to be that witch. So terrible, isn't it? But, you know, there's that kind of thing people say, they're trying to work themselves out of job or make themselves replaceable. That's kind of their, you know, their main goal, to have that open sharing and practice. I think that organizations can do a lot to reward people who are collaborative, who are open to sharing their knowledge, who actively work to avoid that hero status, to people who might find themselves as that person everyone goes to when there's a fire and at the center of everything. I would say, consider why people are coming to you. Do they not feel empowered to act without your kind of say-so? Is there not, you know, have you documented your knowledge and shared it? Could you do that? And would there be some parts of your job you'd happily chop and give away so that you aren't always a single point of failure? You know, a classic question is, what happens when you go on holiday? What would you like to happen when you go on holiday? And if your answer is, I'd love to be pestered at the beach by endless phone calls because I have made myself completely invaluable and I cannot be removed from any situation, then congratulations, you know, do continue. So there's something about targeting those heroes as well and saying, you know, how do you want to live your life? How do you want your peers to view you? And what kind of, you know, work culture, and quite a lot of those wizards or heroes or witches don't want to be that single point of failure. You know, they're working actively against it. So there's that. There's also something about starting small, I think, and just encouraging other people to see themselves as experts. So it's partly on the heroes themselves, but the people around them as well, encourage them to develop, become a hero.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting, that whole concept. I've been around in the cybersecurity world since the late 90s, and it was almost as if way back when cybersecurity was built on the concept of cybersecurity rock stars, which is just another term for heroes. It's just another term for wizards or witches, right? And everybody wanted to be that rock star that found the latest zero day, that figured out the latest problem. And, you know, I feel like that was when, you know, the industry, cybersecurity industry as a whole, was extremely young. I mean, it was basically brand new as an industry. And I feel like we have come a long way since then, and people have come around to the cultural shifts that have to occur for success. It's not just about being the smart person that finds the latest thing, or being, you know, that one person that can solve the one cybersecurity problem within your organization. It has to shift holistically, transformationally, culturally, for security to stick. And it's taken us 2 decades to really start to learn that as a industry. And I'm starting to see it come around more and more with, you know, shows like Cyber Therapy, shows about, you know, the human side of security and how it has to shift for us to be successful. I still feel like we have a long, long way to go. But, you know, the ego-based model, I think, is starting to fade away. Would you agree with that or disagree, given your background?
I mean, I very much hope so. I have a really good anecdote to share here from Margaret Heffernan about super chickens. So if you've not heard about super chickens, it's a really good story. It's a true story as well. So essentially, a farmer took all the he wanted to have chickens that laid the most eggs, right? So he took all his best laying chickens and put them in one pen together, right? Thinking, brilliant, I'm going to have all the best. And then he just had like a pilot group, you know, like a test. You know, got to make it a fair test, right? So exactly. And so the control group. And so what happened? Well, the control group laid so many eggs, it's fine. The super chicken group, quite a lot of them pecked each other to death, right? Because they were super competitive, and it turned out they were just laying more eggs because they were suppressing their competition. It's quite an interesting, the way she tells it is much better than me, obviously. But yeah, Margaret Heffernan, Super Chickens, thank you very much for bringing that up. And it talks about, you know, if you're going to build a great team, like you spoke about at the start of the show, Tyler, if you're going to build a great team, you need people with different strengths. You need those people that, you know, aren't maybe what you'd call superstars, but they are reliable, they are consistent, they are your guardians, bringing process through, you know, always bringing that. And that's a talent. You know, it's not shiny and it's not, you know, fireworks, but that is so needed in every cohesive team. So I think that people are starting to recognize it, and also what's being rewarded is changing. So having a, you know, a very shouting the loudest is no longer acceptable in, like, in many organizations, but especially in security as well. I think people are realizing it needs to be a lot more inclusive to encourage your best talent to come into it.
Well, thank you. I think we've got time for one more question. So I've got one last question, because you're just like a wealth of information. I'm loving this interview and this episode. So I know we only just started September, but we've got Cybersecurity Awareness Month in October, next month. So I wanted to know what, from your perspective, would be a strategy or a tip that you would recommend for people who are maybe non-security specialists, but they're things that security practitioners know and should share with their non-security friends?
It's a great question. I mean, the first thing is, if you're not a security person, we security professionals should be making it easy for you to do the right thing, right? Like, it should be, a lot of it should be taken care of. Hopefully you're not exactly worried about how this video stream is encrypted and you haven't gone into all the details of this website, but you're just looking for those signs that the website's secure, that it seems reliable. You wouldn't enter any payment information into things that don't seem right. So, you know, hopefully a lot of that's taken care of for you. For non-security practitioners, I mean, I have parents who ask me this a lot, what should we be doing? The simplest thing people, security professionals say, is patch. And then non-security people say, what is a patch? Mm-hmm. So even our language needs to update. So update your software, update your phone when it tells you to, update your apps, all that kind of good stuff. That's the simplest thing you could do. And because those processes have been made easy, in fact, in your phone or your router, it should be updating without you even knowing, right? It should just be doing that by default. The thing you could do actively, I know this is like five tips, but I'm like, well, I've got the platform, why not? The thing you could do is just don't take it for granted. So I used to say it was like health, and then we had the pandemic, it became a bit awkward to talk about this, but people take their security a bit like their health, like they sort of take it for granted. And then when they have a health scare or a security scare, that's when they hit the gym, that's when they start eating right, that's when they go, oh, I should have really good passwords. I just say, don't wait for the scare, like, just have a look now. Like, do you have the same password for every account? Just go and sort that out, right? Use a password manager. The tools are there to make it easier than it used to be. And I do know a lot of people started using passwords 20 years ago. It was much harder. You were allowed a 4-character password or whatever with 11111 at the end. But just try to do something a bit different, right? Look at a password manager. Just think about passwords, I would say, in general. Or use non-password methods where you can. Biometrics, things that are easier for you as a human to remember and use. That would be my top tip.
Oh, awesome. Shoot. I got to go change all my passwords now.
Yeah. Often people say, I do update my password. And I'm like, do you just put a 1 at the end? And they're like, the horror.
How did you know?
Or change out the E for a 3.
Yeah. So, you know, just have a look at some good password managers. You can get auto-generating passwords and things.
Yeah.
Just use biometrics. You know, there's a lot of options, really.
Honestly, password managers make it so easy because they can literally generate it for you and then you just save it. You just title what you're saving it for. That's all you have to do. Like, it took me a little bit longer than I should talk about to actually get on board with password managers. But working at security companies kind of like pushed me into that, right? And I think now I'm like, how did I get by without a password manager to manage all my passwords? Mm-hmm. So awesome. Thank you for those tips.
Everything.
I had a list of ones that I would cycle through.
There we go. Yeah.
And variations. So yes, it was not very secure. So, but
yeah, it's looking at the big picture. That's exactly it.
Yes. Awesome. Well, thank you for that. Yeah. What's up, Tyler?
No, I was going to say, let's get to this game. I heard we're doing a game today that has me at a distinct disadvantage.
The perfect place for you to be. Okay, so we are going to play a trivia about cats today. So like we've done in previous episodes, it's usually a themed trivia. Today's trivia is about cats because Kirsty and I, we love cats. And Tyler, I think your Freudian slip earlier about cats tells me that you actually really do like cats down deep down.
No. I do not like cats in any way, shape, or form. And I want to pose a question to the audience. Are you on Team Ashley, which is Team Cat? Or are you on Team Tyler, which is Team Dog? And so please, in the comments down below our streams today, on YouTube, on Twitter, on Twitch, on LinkedIn. I don't think we're live on Twitter, but feel free to tweet us as well on Twitter at cybertherapy, at TXS, and at AshCashN. What do you prefer, cats or dogs? It's an age-old question. And, you know, if you're in the Ghostbusters, cats and dogs are swapping. Who knows? It's just mayhem. Please comment in the comments below. Smash the like, smash the little heart symbol, smash the bell and notify and all those things. And just be Team Tyler. I think it's the better team.
All right. So the way that we're going to play this game is I will alternate people for the questions. So and then it's a question. I will give you four options and then you get to choose the option that you believe is the correct answer.
That's called multiple choice.
Correct. Just being completely and thoroughly wordy about how
Mo said both. He's Team Tyler and Ash. Mo, you got to pick a side, buddy. You can't sit on the fence. That's not an acceptable answer. Go back to the drawing board, my friend.
It's not a Venn diagram. It is two distinct circles.
All right, let's get this game on a roll.
All right, Kirsty, I will start with you. Question is, what's that?
The pressure's on. I'm ready.
Okay. What is the proper term for a group of kittens? Is it a kine, K-I-N-E?
Can I steal right now?
Kettle? Is it kindle? Is it caboodle?
Oh, well, shoot. I had none of those. Never mind. I'm not stealing.
Did you want to steal? Were you thinking litter?
Nope. I was thinking litter for sure.
Do you know, I just want it to be caboodle. So I'm just going to say that because that's what it should be, but it's probably not.
Sadly, it is not.
Do I get a steal chance?
Yes, you do. So you have
three
choices.
Give me my options.
Kine. I don't think I'm saying that right, but kine, kettle, kindle.
It's got to be kind.
K-I-N-E, kine?
Yes, with a D because that's how I pronounced it, but that's not what I meant. Kine is what I meant.
Nope, that is incorrect. It is actually called a kindle.
Ew, I'm never going to use my kindle again. It's going in the trash.
I might go buy a kindle now. Brilliant.
Here, you can have mine, Kirsty. I'll give you mine.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, 0-0.
Yes, 0-0. So we'll start with Kirsty again on this one. Yeah? Since you couldn't steal? Or do you want me to start with you, Tyler?
No,
actually, we'll start with you,
Tyler.
With
me. You got to go
with me. Sorry. Okay.
Yeah, that's fair.
All cats are born with what color eyes? Black, blue, pink, or green?
I got to say blue, like a really light blue.
Final answer?
Yes.
You are correct.
Boom, all one cats, for the good guy.
I knew that one as well. Oh, gutty.
All cats are born with blue eyes and their adult eye color begins to appear at 3 to 12 weeks.
Wow, look at that. I've seen super baby kittens and they always tended to have blue eyes.
It's very cute.
Okay. Tyler's got one. All right, here you go, Kirsty. What percentage of a cat's bones are in its tail? You've got 20%, 2%, there are no bones in a cat's tail, or 10%.
2, 10, 20, 0.
Yeah. That's interesting. Okay, I can narrow it down to 2. I'm going to say 20%. Let's go bold.
That is incorrect.
I'm going the exact opposite. There's not a single bone in there. Which actually, now that I think about it, is wrong too.
Yes, you're wrong.
I know cats that have broken their tail. Therefore, there has to be a bone to break. So that was a dumb answer, but I'll take the L. We're good.
Okay. The true answer is 10%. About 10% of a cat's bones are in its tail.
So you got tricky by putting the 20 in there.
Okay, this one is for Tyler. What is it called when a cat kneads the ground? Kneading, sneagling, rubbing, snuggling.
Are you kidding me right now? You sound like spells from Harry Potter. I snurgle you. Kneading, sneeding, snurgling, and what?
Kneading, sneagling, rubbing, snurgling.
It's got to be sneagling, even though that sounds like a poison that you would eat if you were at Hogwarts.
That is incorrect. Kirsty, would you like to steal?
I would go with kneading.
That is also incorrect. It is actually called snurgling.
Oh my gosh. That is the most inane term ever that I will 100% put in my book of useless information I will remember for the rest of my life.
I'm kind of sad. Yes,
it is the habit that helps their mother produce milk.
So bizarre.
Okay. This question is for Kirsty. How many different sounds can a cat make? 150, 10, 100, 27.
Who's the person that counted this?
What counts as the different, if there are different types of meow, that counts.
I think that counts. I think that counts.
27, very specific.
Unfortunately, no.
Oh, no.
What were my choices again?
150, 10, 100.
100.
Ding, 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 ding. That is correct.
Wow. There we go. Expert. Oh, I'm being shown
and
up.
For the record, so cats can make about 100 different sounds. A dog can only make 10.
Because that's so all a dog needs. They're an elevated form of intelligence and they communicate in 10 sounds. That's how good they are. Kirsty's answer.
That's the British way of saying, I think you're wrong.
That's the polite way of saying you're wrong. Right. I got it.
All right. Tyler, I think this question, because we're on even question.
It is. Yes.
Okay. How many breeds of domestic cats are there worldwide? 70, 140, 280, 210.
210.
Incorrect. Kirsty, would you like to steal?
Oh my gosh.
Your
I'd
options
love to
are 70, yes, 70, please, 140, 280.
I'm going to say 280. I'm just going to.
Nope.
Oh.
140.
There's approximately 70 breeds of domestic cats recognized by the International Progressive Cat Breeders Alliance.
Okay.
There are other ones that only like recognize like less than like 50, but we're going 70. So 70 was the lowest there.
All right. So
nobody got that one.
I'm up 2-0.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're all learning something on this trivia, aren't we?
Two more questions and see if we can give Kirsty the ability to snap me off here and catch up.
Okay. What is the normal body temperature of a cat? 98 degrees Fahrenheit, 94 degrees Fahrenheit, 102 degrees Fahrenheit, 106 degrees Fahrenheit.
You know,
and I apologize because I'm realizing you probably calculate in Celsius.
Idea in Fahrenheit. What's the normal human temperature in Fahrenheit?
98.
I'll go 90. Wait, what were the options? 94, 98.
102
and 106.
102, 106. Okay, I'll go 94. No.
Incorrect. It's gotta be hotter.
Have you ever had a cat sitting on your lap? They're like little furnaces. So it's gotta be hotter than 98. So it's either gotta be 102 or 104. Or 106. I gotta say it's the 102.
Correct. Jeez, Tyler.
Wow. Power of
you're really knocking it out of the park on this one.
What you don't know, Tyler, this is all a ruse for us to find out you're secretly a real cat person.
Yes.
This last question is worth 5 points.
Oh, okay, yeah. Keep it competitive. Here we go.
Winner take all. Let's go. And Kirsty, do you want to go first or second? You get to pick.
I'll go second, I think.
Oh, she thinks I'm going to screw up and give her the steal. All right, let's go.
All right. If a male cat is both orange and black, he is probably sterile, schizophrenic, deaf, blind.
So did we talk about Rudy on the show or in pre-show?
Pre-show.
Okay. Well, for those of you who don't know, I have a cul-de-sac cat named Rudy, and he's the only cat in my life that I've ever met that comes when you call. So I'll walk out my driveway and go, Rudy, and he'll come running from wherever he is, right, to get attention. He is black and orange. And now every time I'm going to see him, I'm going to think that he is like a cuckoo cat or something. Thanks to this question. And I guess if he's the only cat I've ever met that actually comes when he's called, he probably is a cuckoo cat. So what are my choices again?
Sterile, schizophrenic, deaf, blind.
Oh, he's not deaf because he comes when he's called. He's not blind because I've seen him catch animals. He's got to be schizo.
What's Kirsty? What's your answer?
The other one. That's not the one. I forgot.
Sterile.
Sterile. Sterile. There we go.
Sterile. And the answer is sterile.
Oh.
The answer. Kirsty comes away with the win.
Thank you. That last tiebreaker. And the most insulting thing is I used your knowledge about Rudy to get that answer. So thank you.
You did. you 100% used it against me. Well, Rudy is a wonderful cat, and we will continue to feed him off of our back porch. Even though I am not a cat person, we will put out warm milk for Rudy because we love Rudy. So awesome. Well, I think that wraps up our show, right, Ash?
I think so. Kirsty came away with the win. Whew.
She did. Whew. And just because she came away with the win, I've got to kick her off our show. So, Kirsty, it's been a pleasure. Why don't you go wait backstage? Get out of here.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much for having me on here, team. It's been really fun. And thanks for giving me the win, Tyler. I appreciate it.
we'll talk to you in a minute.
Bye.
All right, Ash. Oh, we both clicked the button. There we go. All right, Ash, 2 weeks. Who do we got coming up?
Surprise. I've got no one lined up right now. So stay tuned.
Surprise.
We will have a great show.
I will. I'm sure we'll get a sick, amazing
I've got people
person.
Lined up to have conversations between now and then.
But so. I think this also brings up a good point. If you are somebody who think that if you are a PR person, if you're in marketing, if you have somebody that you'd like to see on this show, please send us a message. We do take recommendations for guests. We don't just want the same show guests as everybody else. We want cool, interesting people like Kirsty, who was, I think, one of my favorite guests so far. Absolutely fabulous content. Thank you again for being on the show. And yeah, if you know of anybody who's interested in being on our show, we are taking guest requests right now. All right, Ash. So no guests in 2 weeks, nothing lined up. We'll get something fun on the calendar. We'll put it on Twitter. We'll let everybody know. Yeah. And otherwise I'm going to see Ashley face to face, tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. We have our marketing team offsite here at Jupiter One. We're going to have a blast. Maybe we'll put some photos on. We'll bring some photos for the next session, for the next show on cyber therapy. And with that, why don't we wrap it up? Ashley, thank you so much.
Thank you. See y'all next time.
All right. Take care, everybody.